You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, lies and conspiracy theories are spreading as bad actors try to undermine the fall elections. We'll learn if it's happening here in Wisconsin and how to spot them. First, according to the AP, the four biggest airlines in the U.S. lost $10 billion combined in the months of April through June. The coronavirus pandemic is the primary driver of significantly reduced air travel, and airlines have been working hard to add and share safety procedures and bring back air travelers.
Every day, we spend between 6 to 7 hours with each aircraft, sanitizing every surface from the flight deck to the back belly.
We will clean customer and team member high-touch areas using the same disinfectant.
Our air circulation system completely circulates the cabin air every 2 to 3 minutes, meaning that
we introduced an electrostatic fogging procedure.
We have expanded electrostatic spraying.
We've also expanded electrostatic spraying across our entire...
If it doesn't meet our standards, our employees have the authority to hold the flight for additional cleaning.
And when you're ready to fly, we're ready for you. We promise.
And while airlines are among the companies that received federal assistance from the first relief package passed months ago, they're saying they need more help now. Seth Kaplan is a transportation analyst for NPR and WBUR's Here and Now. He's a former managing partner at the trade publication Airline Weekly, and he's co-host of the podcast Airlines Confidential. Seth, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be here, Rob.
What is the state of flying today?
Well, you said it. It's a smaller industry than it was, almost non-existent in terms of international flights, but even domestically, far off where things were a year ago, although somewhat up from where they were just several months ago. The question here going forward is how quickly things are going to rebound. There was some optimism a couple months ago as states began reopening, states like Wisconsin, of course, that maybe things wouldn't be so bad. That it would all rebound more quickly than sort of the worst case scenarios. But then you had that second wave of COVID, and looking ahead here, hard to be optimistic that travel is going to be anything like it previously was. Kind of like everything in life, nothing like it previously was anytime soon.
Talk about some of the safety precautions. We heard the advertising there. How much has flying changed in terms of these hygiene options, ones we see and ones we don't?
Yeah, dramatically. I mean, all airlines are cleaning their planes more thoroughly, fogging the planes overnight, even domestic aircraft. That's something they typically did coming off of international flights to get rid of any kind of bugs and so forth that might be foreign objects. But things coming in produce from overseas, that kind of thing. But now domestically, cleaning the planes very deeply, but there are some differences among the airlines, notable differences. For example, blocking the middle seats. Some are doing it, some aren't. Delta recently said that it would continue blocking most middle seats into early January, beyond the New Year period. JetBlue, Alaska, Southwest, a major airline at a lot of airports, still doing that to varying degrees in their cases into October. United and American, among large airlines, aren't doing that. United called that a PR stunt rather than something that actually helps. Obviously, the width of a middle seat, it's 18 inches. It's not true social distancing, not 6 feet. But for people who feel like, well, hey, that's better than nothing, some airlines are offering it and some aren't. So definitely some uniformity among all the airlines in terms of the sanitation, but also some differences.
There's been a lot of public health work to try to figure out how risky being in an airplane with a bunch of other humans is. So what do we know as far as what you're seeing?
Well, it's no riskier than being in that same space with a large number of people. The problem is, obviously, right now, being close to other people carries some risk. So Emory University down in Atlanta, for example, did a study a couple of years ago. So this was before COVID, but just to find out about how people get sick on airplanes. And they basically found out that, you know, people who get sick on airplanes tend to be sitting in middle seats, maybe aisle seats. People get sick less often if they sit in the window seat. There's nothing magical about the window seat. It's just that when you're sitting on the window, you're not surrounded by as many other people. So it's the same kinds of things that expose you in any other environment, being near people who are sick, touching surfaces that might have germs on them. Nothing particular to airplanes. The air really is, as you heard at the beginning there in that mix of the safety announcements, the air really isn't dirtier than other air. So that part's kind of a myth. But if you're sitting right next to somebody who's sick, you're susceptible, just like you would be sitting next to that person at a bar or in any other environment.
Even if people are persuaded that flying is reasonably safe, do they have anywhere to go if their in-person conference has switched to online, if they can't go see the game in the ballpark, whatever? A lot of the reasons we like to fly aren't there anymore, right?
Right, and that's what's driving a lot of this, just like it's driving decreases in public transportation use and driving even, right? These are all what you call, what economists call intermediate goods, right? Something else, something that you use to do something else that you really want to do, right? So exactly. If you can't go to that conference, or if you're not comfortable going and visiting those family members who, you know, you worry about, even if you're not worried about yourself, they are of an age or of an underlying health state that you don't want to expose them to whatever you might have. Those are all reasons not to fly right now. And look, I mean, the reality is that COVID spread around the world largely through travel, right? So it is kind of a delicate dance here. Airlines saying, look, there's no inherent risk to air travel per se, which literally is true because of what I said before, right? There's nothing special about an airplane makes it any worse than anything else. But there are just risks in society right now with COVID being what, the third biggest cause of death at this point in America, behind, I think, cancer and heart disease. So just things we have to mind in any environment. And when we travel, we do take certain risks. We just, as you said, don't have as many things to do and as many places to go right now.
Talking to Seth Kaplan, transportation analyst for NPR, looking at the latest in the airline industry. Seth, as I mentioned, the airlines got some federal help. They're looking for more. What have they gotten? What do they want?
They got $25 billion roughly in grants, most of that $25 billion. They don't have to pay back. Then they were able to get some more loans. The string attached to that first bunch of aid was that they wouldn't furlough any employees. I'm talking direct airline employees. I mean, lots of other job losses throughout the transportation and travel industry. But that expires at the end of September. So now they want more aid. And the major string, again, would be keeping people employed through the end of March, another 6 months. Now, a lot of employees have already accepted buyout packages. The airlines were dangling to try to get people to voluntarily leave. So what they're trying to do is avoid those mandatory furloughs and layoffs. But that's all caught up in much bigger political questions right now, and along with the, are Americans going to get another $1,200 check, stimulus, all that. That's caught up. There seems to be actually some broad support from both sides. President Trump has said he is fine with the idea of airline aid. Democrats, largely, there are some of the more fiscally conservative Republicans who just don't want to spend that kind of money in general. So we'll see what happens there, but probably not so much an airline industry specific answer. It's a question of whether the broader deal gets done.
We asked our listeners on the Ideas Network Facebook page if they had flown lately. Liz writes, I flew at the end of July on Southwest, middle seat vacant, mask required, and required to be properly worn, social distancing in airport. Liz says it seemed that people were very conscientious, didn't seem to be a lot of grumbling, self-isolated for 14 days when I returned home, Liz says. We see, the horror story videos online, Seth, fights breaking out over somebody didn't wear their mask or whatever, but by and large, are things going pretty smoothly?
Yeah, and I think they've gone more smoothly ever since the airlines have stopped allowing very many exceptions. They basically said at this point, if you're more than 2 years old, you need to be wearing a mask. And if you can't do it, in the case of a lot of these airlines, for whatever reason, no matter how legitimate, then maybe you just can't travel right now. That's pretty much the position that they've taken. Earlier on, a lot of judgment in the hands of employees. And that led to a lot of those situations we've seen. There was a fight just the other day on an American Airlines flight that, the video is on the internet. I mean, it's still happening, but seems to be more consistent enforcement than there had been at the beginning.
Last minute, Seth, what are you watching for next?
Looking ahead in Wisconsin, I took a quick look before what airlines are scheduling going forward. So on one hand, a lot more people are traveling now than a few months ago. On the other hand, again, with that second wave of COVID, each month starting in May, there had been more seats than the month prior as a percentage of what there was a year ago. In September, that goes into reverse a little bit. August was the high. We're in the middle of it. 62% as many seats leaving Wisconsin airports as August 2019. In September, back down to 51%. So let's see in October and going forward what airlines are scheduling, because that tells us, that's kind of their crystal ball in terms of how many people they think are going to be flying.
Seth, thanks again for joining us today.
You got it, Rob. Thank you.
Seth Kaplan is a transportation analyst for NPR and WBUR's Here and Now. He's a former managing partner for Airline Weekly. We talked to him about the tough financial situation facing airlines and what the fall could look like as the pandemic continues. Coming up, we'll find out how false information aimed at disrupting elections is making its way to people here in Wisconsin. That's up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Republicans have been trying to allow oil drilling in the Alaska National Wildlife Refuge for 40 years. This week, President Trump gave the plan a green light. Coming up, we'll hear from a supporter and a critic of the proposal. Now, lies and conspiracy theories are spreading as bad actors try to undermine elections. It's happening here in Wisconsin, especially online. Max Witinski recently graduated from UW-Madison with a master's degree in journalism. He reported about disinformation for Wisconsin Watch, and he talked with WPR host Keely Boltina.
So misinformation and disinformation, those are different. Misinformation refers to mistakes that happen or inaccurate information, but disinformation is intentional?
That's right. So misinformation can be the result of disinformation. If there's a bad actor online who's spreading a message that they know to be false, but then someone else sees it and thinks, oh my gosh, I need to alert other people to this problem, but they don't realize that it's fake, then it becomes misinformation.
Gotcha. So disinformation has this intent that it's fabricated or deliberately manipulated.
That's right.
So how do we know people in our state are targets of disinformation campaigns?
We know for a couple of reasons. One is because of research done at the University of Wisconsin-Madison by Professor Youngmi Kim, and who's a fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice, who has studied disinformation on social media pretty widely. We also know because of research that was cited in the Mueller report on election interference by Josephine Lucido, who's a recent graduate from the UWJ school. And then we also know just from looking online and seeing disinformation, it's pretty widespread, and Wisconsin has been specifically targeted by some of the foreign actors like Russia because it's a swing state. So disinformation, unfortunately, is pretty common on news feeds on Facebook and Instagram across the state.
And we know there are many different ways to spread disinformation. Memes are one of them. What's a meme again? How do people make them?
So a meme is just an image with text pasted across it. Usually they're intended to be funny, but they can also have malicious intent. And oftentimes it's kind of a subtle combination, which is what we usually see with disinformation. So maybe a meme making fun of Joe Biden, that's the example that we used in our article. But at the same time, it kind of implies that he has dementia.
Tell us more about that. What did it look like?
So the meme is just a picture of Biden. It's actually captured from his campaign announcement video. And the text is, "I'm Joe Biden and I forgot this message," which kind of makes you laugh because it calls to mind, you know, what people say at the end of a campaign announcement video, which is, "I'm Joe Biden and I approve this message." But if you look in the top right corner, you can see it has a little watermark from this group, Americans for Liberty 76, which is kind of a shady group on Facebook. They don't provide a lot of context for their messaging. And one of their major goals, it seems like, is to kind of stir up emotions, kind of get partisans riled up, essentially. And sowing division in and of itself is one of the big goals.
And we should note, Joe Biden never said that. That's not a circumstance. There's no evidence that he has dementia. But this thing that was supposed to be funny kind of still leaves you with this this mistruth lingering in the back of your head.
Right, exactly. So maybe even if you like Joe Biden, you might have second thoughts like, oh, well, maybe he's not actually as fit for the presidency as I think he is. Maybe someone else would have a better candidate. Your enthusiasm for him is a little bit lower. And maybe if millions of people see a message like that, or thousands of messages like that are out there in the media stream, you might actually get lower turnout.
Yeah, even when none of it is true. How can we track how far those untrue messages spread?
So it's actually a pretty tricky thing to track. But there are Senate Intelligence Committee reports on this topic that suggest it's in the millions or hundreds of millions. Content from the Internet Research Agency, which is a St. Petersburg-based organization that has some ties to the Kremlin. Basically, it's a troll factory where people are putting out false information around the clock. The Senate Intelligence Committee report says that between 2015 and 2017, there were actually 187 million engagements on Instagram in the form of likes, comments, and shares. So it's really pervasive.
Wow. We're talking with Matt Witinsky, who's written about disinformation for Wisconsin Watch. People looking to undermine our trust in government are targeting people in Wisconsin, especially when it comes to politics. This is the Ideas Network. Max, whose responsibility is this? What have you found?
So I think the responsibility falls to a number of people. One would be obviously the social media companies, who need to do a better job kind of policing their own platforms. Some of the onus, though, to take action is also on us as social media users and as citizens, just to call out this information when we see it, tell our friends to be really cautious and, you know, take everything that they see on social media with a grain of salt and refer to trusted media that's fact-checked.
And we've seen some inappropriate, untrue attacks on the media. And yet in this case, media outlets are also responsible for context. You use an example of a tweet from President Donald Trump.
That's right. President Trump, throughout his presidency, I would say, but especially recently, has been seeking to undermine confidence in the fall 2020 election, especially as it pertains to mail-in voting. And this is largely disinformation. The Postal Service is pretty well equipped to handle mail-in ballots. It's something that they've been doing for years. Some states actually vote entirely by mail, like Colorado and Utah. And people really should have confidence that their ballots will be counted. What they do need to do is carefully follow the steps that are put out by the elections commissions in their states. So they need to request the ballots early. They need to get the witness signature, and they need to return them such that clerks will have enough time to process them. But fraud is actually really rare.
So when the president makes a statement like that, news organizations simply can't retweet. We have to provide context to help people understand that this is what he said and it's not true.
Right. And that also creates more work for news outlets. So he's basically sowing what's sometimes called information disorder there. So some people think, oh, the election is potentially fraudulent. Then the news has to correct them. And it just becomes this cycle where people are less sure what the truth actually is.
You mentioned sock puppet accounts. What are those?
So a sock puppet, in the context that we discuss it in the article, is usually a Russian actor impersonating an American. So some of these accounts during the 2016 election cycle actually garnered thousands and thousands of followers. Basically, people expressing really patriotic views and usually support for things like the Second Amendment, President Trump sometimes. In reality, they weren't based in the U.S. at all. And they were just trying to tip the balance of the election. Or in many cases, just prevent people from voting via dissuasion. So another thing that we would see is same side candidate attack, where you see someone maybe pretending to be a Bernie supporter, attacking Hillary or something like that. And that ultimately leads to lower voter turnout for Hillary, even though they were running in the same party.
So with so many different ways that people are trying to spread lies to us, how are we supposed to go about this? I think I remember one of the examples one of your experts said was just try to look past it online. That's hard to do.
Yeah, it is hard to do. I think fortunately, we still have a pretty robust election infrastructure, especially in Wisconsin. So if people are paying attention to media that's fact-checked, like Wisconsin Watch, like Wisconsin Public Radio, and I think talking with one another also, and not just becoming kind of siloed in their information bubbles, I think there's a good chance that we can have a free and fair election with good participation.
Max, thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much.
As reporter Max Witinski talking with WPR host Keely Boltina, they talked about how false information aimed at damaging elections is making its way to people in Wisconsin. This Wisconsin Watch piece is part of the Narrow Margin Project, investigating voter security, voter suppression, and disinformation in Wisconsin this 2020 election season. You can read the full article by Max Witinski and Jessica Christopher online. We've got a link at our website, wpr.org/centraltime. Coming up, we'll get two takes on the Trump administration's plan to open the Alaska National Wildlife Refuge to drilling. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show, COVID-19 has had a big impact on Wisconsin's foster care system. Kate Archer-Kent and her guests take a look at the changes and how families and kids are adapting. That's tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, the Trump administration announced this week that it will open the Alaska National Wildlife Refuge to drilling, a goal Republicans have been trying to accomplish for 40 years or so. The move would allow oil and gas rights to be auctioned off on the 1.6 million acre coastal plain. That area is home to polar bears and foxes that live there year round, as well as migrating caribou and birds. In a conference call with reporters on Monday, Interior Secretary David Bernhardt said the move is a win for American energy independence. Environmentalists criticized the plan and vowed to fight it in court. You can let us know how you feel at 800-642-1234. Should the U.S. allow drilling in this wildlife refuge in Alaska or not? Do you think the economic benefits are the thing to focus on, the possible job creation and energy needs met? Or is this a loser, as you see it, for a pristine environmental area? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll get two perspectives this half hour. First up, Frank Macchiarola, Senior Vice President of Policy, Economics, and Regulatory Affairs at the American Petroleum Institute. Frank, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Sure. Thanks for having me on.
Make the case that opening up parts of this refuge for drilling would be the right thing to do.
Sure. Well, you know, it's important first to put this into context. So the coastal plain area is a very small part of the overall ANWR area. It's about 8% in total of ANWR, and it holds tremendous energy opportunities. So the U.S. Geological Survey estimates 10.4 billion barrels of oil, which is enough to produce about 1 million barrels per day for nearly 30 years in the area. So it's it's a strong opportunity to continue to our energy security in the United States. And it also has the support of the people. Roughly 70% of Alaskans support producing responsibly in this area, including the natives that live in the region. And so we think it's a prudent step by the Department of the Interior to follow the statutory directive they've been given by Congress, and we support the decision.
And Congress, in doing this, part of the goal here was to raise money for the federal government in order to balance out some tax cuts at the time. How much of an economic benefit do you see this being for the federal budget?
Well, we think the proof is in. Well, it obviously depends upon interest in the area, and certainly the royalty rates depend upon historical prices over the life of the leases. But what I can say is, if you look to the history of Alaska, it's very telling. So Alaska is the only state that does not have either an income tax or a sales tax. And the Alaska budget over time has been supported by oil and gas revenues. And that's why I think you see the significant support from the people of Alaska to have this development in their area.
Environmentalists have been critical, of course, of this decision. This argument goes back decades. Our next guest from the Alaska Wilderness League said, I'm quoting, "Our climate is in crisis. Oil prices have cratered. Major banks are pulling out of Arctic financing right and left." Let's hit a couple of those points. Some of the criticism here is, hey, we've got climate change going on. We're seeing storms on both coasts as part of this. Is this a time to open the door to more oil exploration and drilling?
We as an industry actually recognize and are taking action to meet the challenge of climate change. In fact, the single biggest attribute of our industry over the past decade has been this revolution in natural gas production that has driven down emissions. It's the single greatest factor in reducing CO2 emissions. But while we do that, while we meet that challenge, we also have the important challenge of continuing to meet our growing energy needs. And what experts tell us is, over the next 30 years, we are going to continue globally and in the United States to continue to use oil and natural gas as the primary energy source. And so, from our perspective, it makes all the sense in the world for that oil and that gas to come from the United States. Why? Because we do it environmentally better. It strengthens our energy security, and it provides a tremendous economic benefit for the United States. Just consider, our industry supports more than 10 million jobs in the United States, and the jobs directly within the industry are good-paying jobs, nearly twice the average private sector income or salary than the private sector. And so it's also 8% of the U.S. economy that the oil and gas is responsible for. And so to be able to meet the climate challenge that society is facing and also deliver the energy that we need is a challenge that our industry tackles every day.
We are talking about possible drilling on the Alaska Wildlife Refuge, the Trump administration giving a green light to start taking bids on parts of it for oil exploration. Getting two perspectives on it today, Frank Macchiarola with us right now from the American Petroleum Institute. Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Dave is with us in Okano County. Dave, hi.
Good afternoon.
What do you think?
Hey, Dave.
Yes, with the accumulation of excess oil already being pushed through the United States, and everybody claims that their product is going to better the economy, it only betters the people who are infested or show interest in it. The amount of damage that it'll leave behind to that part of the earth is totally irreparable, and you can't reverse anything you do. What needs to be done is the energies that we're using now, and we can take the crude oil. if you can extract that carbon molecule from that piece of oil and get all the energy you can out of it, you will have a lot of energy there. The natural gas that comes off the top of every oil well, we keep in mind that it's the CO2 that heats up the earth, but it's the methane that that erodes away at the upper atmosphere. And when those two are gone, you got the red planet. And oil right now, if you got the money, you got the power, and the people have very little voice in how to protect themselves, and they don't have the money to buy a lawyer to get the protection that they need. So it kind
Dave,
of
thanks a lot for the call. You gave us a lot there. He's worried that the profits go to few, and he's worried about long-term damage from the extraction and then with the climate, I think, Frank.
Yeah, sure. You know, first with respect to the area itself. So it's important to note that currently in the area adjacent to the coastal plain in Port Thompson on state lands, there already exists safe and responsible oil and gas production that, again, has drawn the support of the Alaskan and Alaskan natives who live there. So this is something that's locally supported. Again, nearly 70% or approximately 70% of Alaskans, you know, with respect to the cost issue, something that's very important. One of the interesting factors of the oil and gas revolution here in the United States that has really strengthened our security here at home is also what it's done to costs for the average consumer. Over that 10-year period, as we've seen, healthcare costs, education costs, and food costs all increase by double digits percentage-wise. We've seen nearly an 11% decrease in average household costs for energy. Why? Because we're producing more of it here in the United States at a low cost, affordable for the consumer. And again, as I noted, because of the natural gas revolution that we've seen, we've actually, as we've doubled production in the United States over that period of time, we've actually reduced CO2 emissions. And so the U.S. is really becoming a leader in this space, both as the leading producer of oil and gas, but also as a leader in addressing the challenge of reducing CO2 emissions as well.
Thanks for that call. We'll go to Lyric with us now in Monroe. Lyric, hello.
Hi. I'm so angry I could spit nails. All he talks about is money. I lived in Fairbanks, Alaska. I went up there in 1975 when the pipeline was going up through there. And I've hiked twice north of the Brooks Range out to the Arctic Ocean. Number one, before Alaska was divided up and partitioned off into what they have now, there are 26 distinct Native American groups in Alaska. The caribou herd that comes up out of Canada and comes up through the Brooks Range and then out towards the Arctic Ocean, and why we're not working with Canada and they're a Native American citizens is a travesty also. Our culture has damaged those spiritual, cultural ideas of the Native Americans that live up there, that Alaska has the highest rape rate, suicide rate, drug rate, rape rate, you name it. What we need to do is sit back and say, how can we work with this without the pipeline? When they put
Lyric, I'm going to jump in because we're just about out of time. Lyric, concerned about the impact on Native American communities and in some cases migratory species they rely on, Frank.
Yeah, sure. The caller raised the issue of caribou. Actually, only one caribou herd, the Central Arctic herd, ranges in the area where oil production currently takes place in and around Prudhoe Bay. And actually, if you look at the number of caribou over time, it's grown during peak oil production on the North Slope from about 5,000 in 1975 to a herd roughly 22,000 in 2016. That's a 340% increase during that period of time. The fact of the matter is, the people who would be most closely impacted by this, the people of Alaska, both the natives and Alaskans, overwhelmingly support this, and it's also a bipartisan issue. So both Republicans and Democrats and Republican and Democrat policymakers in Alaska have supported responsible production in the coastal plain area for generations.
Larry, and thanks
this is really what the federal government here is doing, is providing, you know, in the view of the Alaskans, it's really to provide a delivering on a promise that was made to them at the time of statehood. And for the American people, what it means is more production of essential energy that's affordable and reliable and drives our economic development and our standards of living.
Lyric, thanks for that call. And Frank, thanks for joining us today.
Sure. Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
Frank Macchiarola is Senior Vice President of Policy, Economics, and Regulatory Affairs at the American Petroleum Institute. We talked to him about his support for the Trump administration's plans to open parts of the Alaska National Wildlife Refuge for oil exploration and drilling. Coming up, we'll talk to a critic of the proposal, and you can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the Trump administration's plan to open the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to oil exploration and drilling. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and reactions. We just heard from a supporter of the plan. Now we welcome a critic. Adam Colton is Executive Director of the Alaska Wilderness League. Adam, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on, Rob.
Make the case for us that drilling in this refuge is the wrong move.
Well, it's an easy case to make. I mean, this is a place that President Dwight Eisenhower set aside as a wildlife refuge more than half a century ago because it had the highest peaks and glaciers of the Brooks Range, the rolling tundra lagoons and barrier islands along the Beaufort Sea coast. And so it's really one of the wildest places left on the planet. It's also often called America's Serengeti because in this narrow band of land between the mountains and the coast, that's where you have hundreds of thousands of caribou come each and every year to calve, give birth to their young. It's a place where polar bears come on shore to build their winter maternity dens, where you can find rare musk oxen and millions of migratory birds that fly to or through every state in five continents, including tundra swans, snow geese, sandhill cranes you might find in Wisconsin.
We've heard from the Interior Secretary, and we just heard from the Petroleum Institute that they agree with you and that that's okay because they've figured out how to drill responsibly in Alaska, so there's not much worry about damage to the environment. What do you say to that?
Well, I mean, really? I mean, does anybody – these are the same oil companies that are drilling elsewhere, you know, that brought us the disasters in the Gulf, the Exxon Valdez. So we really trust them that they're going to drill responsibly in the wildest place left in America. And let's remember that scientists that work at the Fish and Wildlife Service that have studied the wildlife up there say there are huge risks to caribou, polar bears, and also not only the wildlife, but the Gwich'in Athabascan people, many of the indigenous people who live in that region in Alaska and Canada, they depend on the caribou herd for 80% of their diet in some of these villages. It's a huge cultural component of their lifestyle. So they're really fighting for their cultural survival here, and they're opposed to this. Scientists, Gwich'in leaders, the Episcopal Church, sportsmen, conservationists, who do you trust on this? The oil companies saying they're to do it safely?
And we also hear from the oil companies and some elected officials in Alaska that this is going to be a job creator, a big economic benefit, especially for Alaska, with some benefits for the federal budget as well. Is there a way to do that, to take those benefits and still protect the environment?
I mean, it's shocking that your guests from the American Petroleum Institute would argue that. I mean, right now in this COVID crisis, what's the big problem? We have an oversupply crisis in the United States. Oil markets have been cratering. And moreover, the Alaskan oil, I mean, some of the big companies have actually been pulling back from Alaska because there's cheaper oil elsewhere in the lower 48. So, for example, British Petroleum sold off its Alaska assets. Shell pulled out of Alaska. The idea that somehow this is going to be some huge, super elephant, fine, big job bonanza just doesn't square with the reality of the economic picture. But I think the other important point is the Trump administration is saying it sees getting the first drop of oil out of the Arctic refuge in 10 years and then producing for 50 years. Can you imagine that? We're trying to transition away from our dependence on fossil fuels right now. Who wants to make a 50-year bet on increasing climate change? I mean, we're talking about 4.3 billion metric tons of new carbon pollution coming out of a remote and wild area for 50 years. I mean, that's the exact the wrong direction. So if we're serious about climate change, we really have to create the jobs in other sectors.
Talking to Adam Colton from the Alaska Wilderness League, looking at Trump administration at the Trump administration giving the go-ahead to possible oil drilling in the Alaska National Wildlife Refuge. We heard from the American Petroleum Institute earlier. Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Nate is with us in Eau Claire. Nate, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
What did you want to bring up, Nate?
I'm a student at the University of Wisconsin's Sustainable Management Program, and I was doing some research just last semester on the how much time we have left as far as the world's capacity for the crude oil that's available and how long we would actually be able to continue to use it. But at our rate of consumption, the world would run out of crude oil relatively quick. I can't remember the exact number, but it would be less than 100 years. So it seems short-sighted to continue to look to crude oil as a means of energy.
Nate, thanks for the call. Adam?
No, that's a great point, Nate. And by the way, proud graduate of the University of Wisconsin myself. I mean, look, right now the Trump administration is rolling back fuel economy standards that would save far more oil than we can get from the Arctic Refuge, the Persian Gulf, Venezuela, other countries combined. You know, we had put these things in place to actually move away from our oil dependence. And for some reason, a crazy policy is trying to increase our oil dependence right now. So you're absolutely right, Nate. And you know, we don't have to be drilling in these wild, remote landscapes. We do need to figure out how to more aggressively transition away. We have the technology to do it. We can make our cars go much further in a gallon of gas in the interim while we advance electric vehicles and other solutions.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go now to Kathy with us in Lac des Flambeaux. Kathy, hi.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I am calling to say that the ultimate thing is to protect our water. I am a Native American of the Turtle Mountain Pemina Band of Chippewa, and my father was from Cannonball, North Dakota. I'm aware of the spills over there by the Yellowstone confluence as well as others, and what we are going through with the Mackinac Straits and what the Bad River Reservation is going through with trying to, they stopped their leases to the oil company. And I think everything should be put on hold considering all the criminal activity going on with the people that deal with Trump. And
Kathy, thanks a lot for the call. Just less than a minute left, Adam, that concern over risks to waterways that she brings up.
No, it's a valid concern. And you know, the water resources of the Arctic Refuge are scarce. There aren't a lot of water. And actually, for drilling activities, you need to use enormous quantities of fresh water to build ice roads and support drilling activities. It's a real challenge in the refuge and something that the Trump administration hasn't given much attention to.
Thanks for that call. And Adam, thanks for being with us today.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll just leave you with some optimism. I believe we're going to stop this. So if folks want to get involved, go to www.alaskawild.org to get involved in the fight.
Adam Colton is executive director of the Alaska Wilderness League. We talked to him about his opposition to President Trump's plan to open the Alaska National Wildlife Refuge to oil drilling and exploration. Earlier, we heard from Frank Macchiarola of the American Petroleum Institute, which supports the decision. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, politics in 2020 isn't just about who you vote for, it's about how you vote. We'll find out why mail-in voting has become so politicized and what it means for November elections. We'll take a last look at the Democratic National Convention and the tone it sets for the final stretch of the campaign. And it's this week's edition of Food Friday. Put off something you could do today and do some baking instead. The author of the new cookbook, Procrastibaking, joins the show. That's coming up tomorrow on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 6, get ready for a Wisconsin weekend with a tour of great summer beers made here in the state. That's tomorrow at 6 here on the Ideas Network. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then, is the internet making us stupid, narcissistic, lonely? Two professors look to the past to try to understand how technology has changed our emotions in the last two centuries, from telegraphs to Twitter. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.